Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, nothing quite like the spectacle of millionaire pundits celebrating cuts to Social Security benefits. Part of what has elites so jazzed about Obama's budget is the way it achieves benefits cuts through tweaks, like a change in the benefit formula. We'll ask the Center for Economic and Policy Research's Nicole Wu what the real-world effects of that tweak are likely to be. Also on the show, Dr. Kermit Gosnell is on trial for murders he's alleged to have committed at his illegal abortion clinic in Philadelphia. The story has been covered in gruesome detail since Gosnell's arrest in 2011, but what's been missing from the reporting? We'll hear from Aaron Grant, a Philadelphia abortion provider and a contributor to RH Reality Check, about that. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at the week's press.
By the time you hear this, media may have already entered the self-assessment phase of their coverage of the Boston Marathon bombing. You'll forgive us for remaining unmoved by the pretense that reporters really want to change the way they behave in such cases, rushing to air with rumor and speculation, no matter who it hurts, because there it was again. We had media seeking expert advice from folks like Steve Emerson. He's the one who declared that the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995 showed a Middle Eastern trait because it, quote, was done with the intent to inflict as many casualties as possible, close quote. And there he was on C-SPAN the day after the Boston bombs, taking credit for pointing the finger at the Saudi national, the young man injured in the attack and then treated wrongly as a suspect. And there he was on Fox, asserting that, quote, ball bearings are the highlight of the jihadist type of suicide bombing in the Middle East, close quote. From the Daily Beast, we got Al-Qaeda's recipe for pressure cooker bombs, in which Eli Lake explained the devices in Boston, quote, resemble the kind of homemade bomb Al-Qaeda has encouraged English-speaking terrorists to use, close quote. Of course, they also resemble the devices described in the Anarchist Cookbook, published in 1971, and those that people post YouTube videos of themselves blowing up in empty fields. Because actually, neither pressure cooker bombs nor ball bearings are particular hallmarks of a certain kind of attacker. That kind of invidious conjecture, sadly, is a hallmark of a press corps that would rather screw up and pretend to apologize than stop screwing up in the first place.
Terror returns, read USA Today's inch-high headline on April 16th, while a smaller headline read, that post-9/11 quiet, it's over. Reporters Rick Hampson and Chuck Rosch wrote that the Boston bombing had shattered, quote, a fragile hope formed slowly in the years since 2001 that maybe it won't happen here, not again. Then it did, close quote. Quiet since 2001? As USA Today itself reported last year, such mass slayings are alarmingly common in the United States, with 774 people killed in 156 incidents between 2006 and 2010. Mass killings occur in USA once every 2 weeks, that headline pointed out. Even assuming the Boston slaughter is politically motivated and therefore meets the definition of terrorism, it's still far from unique in post-September 11th America. Among the long list of incidents, you'd find the anthrax letters that killed five in late 2001, the murder of two at the Knoxville Unitarian Church in 2008 shootings targeting liberals, the assassination the next year of abortion provider George Tiller, and the killing of six at a Sikh temple in Wisconsin just last August. The fact that journalists could fail to recognize that political violence has been part of the United States' recent landscape is testament not to short memories, but to a narrow definition that dismisses right-wing domestic violence as not really terrorism, and perhaps to a sheer will to believe that George W. Bush kept us safe after 9/11. The public needs a press corps focused on reality, even when it's not so comforting.
If we had the vigorous critical press corps we really need, we wouldn't be so struck by incidents like the one that occurred on April 17th. In a press conference with the White House press secretary, Jay Carney, a reporter noted that Barack Obama had referred to the Boston bombing as terrorism and asked, quote, "Do you consider the U.S. bombing on civilians in Afghanistan earlier this month that left 11 children and a woman killed a form of terrorism? Why or why not?" Close quote. 12 years into the U.S.-led war on Afghanistan, a keystone, we're to understand, of something called the War on Terror, with tens of thousands of innocent civilians killed, this should be a whole realm of sustained journalistic inquiry. But Carney seemed ill-prepared for the simple question from McClatchy's Amina Ismail. He gave a rambling and bland response, beginning with saying, obviously, she should be talking to the Defense Department, and ending with the pronouncement that, quote, "We take great care in the prosecution of this war, and we are very mindful of what our objectives are," close quote. Perhaps the worst part is that seemed to satisfy the rest of the reporters in the room, leading to the worry that it isn't just that they don't really understand the grounds on which the U.S. is perpetrating violent and destructive military actions, but that they aren't all that eager to find out.
New York Times reporter John Burns is sentimental over Margaret Thatcher. Last week, it was how she restored self-confidence in the Britain of his youth. This week, he remembered her mid-80s battles with coal miners when tens of thousands lost their jobs to her, quote, union-busting battle to close unprofitable coal mines in 1984 and 1985, close quote. As Burns sees it, quote, "Many years on, what happened to coal mining is reckoned, for better or worse, as a watershed moment for Britain. It was in the coal fields, more than anywhere, that a socialist vision that prized the welfare of blue-collar communities over profit finally yielded to a new era of individualism, entrepreneurship, and for millions beyond the coal fields, prosperity," close quote. Well, it sort of sounds as though Burns sees this as for better, doesn't it? And why not, if there are just thousands of lost jobs, blue-collar at that, compared with prosperity for the millions? Except that Burns pulled that part out of his ear. The actual record shows Thatcher's years brought increased poverty, inequality, unemployment, record high interest rates, and for all the hype, only slightly increased growth over the dread 1970s. Well, Thatcher's case provides a contrast to reporting on Hugo Chavez, which routinely ignores real improvements for millions, dramatic increases in growth and decreases in poverty and inequality, to focus instead on negatives, as when USA Today reported on April 16th that Chavez, quote, "left Venezuela with high unemployment, soaring inflation, and food shortages," close quote. Again, unemployment dropped from 14% to 8% under Chavez, but that's really immaterial because these reports aren't critical journalism so much as morality tales, which extol the powerful and demonize those who don't.
And finally, while the Boston bombings have shifted media attention away from North Korea, days before the marathon, there were new fears on the front page. North Korea thought to have warhead, said the April 12th Washington Post. And the New York Times, Pentagon says nuclear missile is in reach for North Korea. But the stories were much less than they appeared. What happened was that a Republican congressman, Doug Lamborn, revealed at a hearing on missile defense that a sentence in a Defense Intelligence Agency report raised the possibility, with moderate confidence, that North Korea could fit a nuclear weapon onto a missile. Lamborn's intent was perfectly clear. As he explained, he shared the information because he thinks the United States should spend more money on missile defense schemes. So if you read past the headlines and around the alarmism, you could figure out there's not much there. But that shouldn't be the job of readers. Reuters, for one, added some background, noting that the Defense Intelligence Agency had been especially hawkish on Iraq's WMDs. A few days after pumping up the story, the Times published a piece with a more critical, you could say more responsible, approach. The headline on that one, "Contrasting Views on North Korea Underscore Sensitivities and Lack of Evidence." Better late than never, we suppose.
Thanks, Steve. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group. Mm-hmm. Economic policy is something journalists write a lot of words about, but they tend to be the same words over and over. They often skim over terms or ideas they ought to unpack. Right now, you're hearing about a proposal, part of Obama's budget, to alter the formula for determining benefit levels for Social Security. The move to what's called the chained CPI is presented in the press as a sensible measure, part of a White House effort to appeal to the center. That's the elite media hallucination of a wide swath of the public calling for cuts to benefit programs. So what would this chained CPI actually mean to different communities and for the economy overall? Here to help us with this is Nicole Wu, Director of Domestic Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. She joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to Counterspin, Nicole Wu.
It's good to be here, Janine.
Well, we want to talk about the impacts of this change, which I think are broader than some people may realize. But first, what do proponents of the chained CPI mean when they say it's a more accurate measure of cost of living? And does that assessment hold water for you?
The chained CPI stands for the Chained Consumer Price Index. And that's one of the ways that the government measures inflation. Social Security benefits, but also a whole swath of other benefits, such as veterans benefits, are also bracketed to inflation, and so are our income tax brackets. You know, every year our income tax brackets go up a little bit according to the government's official measure of inflation. And moving to a chained CPI would actually slow down the rate of these adjustments every year. In Social Security, it's called a cost of living adjustment, or a COLA. The way the chained CPI does it is that they take into account the behavior of people when they're faced with higher prices. They might switch what they choose to buy. You know, for example, if the price of chicken has gotten very expensive, they might switch to buying cheese. So the chained CPI would show that people are spending on cheaper products, and so cost of living adjustments would be lower every year. So that certainly affects seniors in Social Security. It's about a 3% cut after 10 years, 6% after 20 years, or 9% after 30 years. In dollar amounts, that would be, you know, for someone who retires at age 65, that would be a cut of about $650 a year by age 75 and over $1,000 a year at age 85. And we know that Social Security beneficiaries are not rolling in dough. 40% of Social Security beneficiaries rely on it for over 90% of their income, and the average Social Security benefit is less than $15,000 a year. So a cut of $650 or over $1,000, as you get older and older, the effects of the chained CPI get worse. You know, it's real money, and it would be real hardship for seniors. Another problem with this chained CPI is that seniors can't substitute their purchases in the same way that working-age Americans can. Seniors spend more of their money proportionally on health care and housing, and they can't really trade, you know, a heart bypass for an angioplasty or something like that.
Right, right.
They're stuck with their health costs and their housing costs. There's actually been an experimental index that the government has looking just at seniors' costs, and it goes in completely the opposite direction. It shows what I think we all know. If you talk to a senior, they probably would say that their cost of living increase for Social Security is not enough rather than too high. And the government's experimental kind of look into this shows the same thing. It shows that seniors' costs have actually been going up higher, faster, rather than more slowly.
So when USA Today says in an editorial that this is a slightly less generous and more accurate formula for calculating inflation, it sounds as though they're not really right on either point. It's not just a slight cost for people who are already, you know, not living high off the hog, and then it's not necessarily more accurate for those substitution reasons particular to seniors that you point out.
Right. Those are both excellent points. Especially for seniors, it doesn't make sense, and meanwhile, they're planning to apply this specifically to seniors. But, you know, it does affect all of us. It would affect our income tax brackets. So last year, Social Security beneficiaries got 1.7% of an increase in their cost of living adjustment. And our income tax brackets, you know, ratcheted up the same amount. So if our tax brackets go up at a slower rate, then we will start falling up into higher tax brackets more quickly. the Joint Committee on Taxation, a nonpartisan official body of the government that looks into these things, found that because the wealthy are already in the highest tax bracket, they're not affected by this as much as the rest of us who would be moving up into higher tax rates more quickly. And they found that about 70% of the higher taxes gathered by the chain CPI would be paid by middle-income and lower-income working Americans. So it gets us on both sides. It gets us on the benefit side when we're retired or have other benefits like veterans benefits, and it gets us on the tax side.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me ask you finally, the skew of the media debate is such that cutting benefits is presented as the middle way between extremes. And among other things, this means that actual reasonable economic responses can't even be spoken in a way because they make no sense in the debate as currently framed. And in this case, the idea that we should be increasing Social Security now that people have fewer pensions or no pensions and no individual savings, not cutting Social Security, but increasing it. From your sober economist's perspective, that's far from crazy talk, isn't it?
Oh, there's plenty of evidence. You make a great point that Social Security benefits really are inadequate, especially, as you said, with, you know, people's pensions and housing values and stock portfolios having been wiped out in the Great Recession. And another point is about, you know, budget deficits. Social Security actually doesn't contribute to the deficit at all by law. It can only pay out benefits that are covered by the payroll taxes that working Americans pay in and any interest that they make on their bonds. So since 1983, American workers have been paying extra into the system. They've been paying more into Social Security than it pays out. There's now about $2.5 trillion, with a T, $2.5 trillion in surplus in Social Security. There's no other government program with a surplus like that. You know, they call it the trust fund. And so, you know, by cutting these benefits by a little bit, percentage-wise it's a little bit, but for actual retirees it's a lot of money, they're not actually going to help with the deficits. And they are, in many ways, changing the game, which working Americans have been playing fairly. They've been putting more money in. They've earned these benefits. And another interesting thing with the president's budget is that they didn't talk about one of the most popular and simple ways to get Social Security on track, because in about 20 years, that trust fund will run out, which would mean that Social Security would have to pay only about 75% of benefits. Nobody wants to see a drop like that, and it would be a real problem. But one way to fix that is that we have a cap on the amount of pay that is covered by the Social Security tax. This year it is at $113,700. It goes up with inflation every year. That means a millionaire is paying Social Security tax on a little bit more than one-tenth of their income, while everyone making under $100,000 a year is paying the Social Security tax on all of their income.
Right.
So one very easy way to fix some of the shortfall in Social Security that's seen several decades out from here is to just raise that cap and have wealthy Americans pay the same rate of Social Security taxes as all the rest of us. It polls really well, as you could imagine. It gets at higher income earners rather than the middle class, whom President Obama promised not to raise taxes on. And yet this does not appear in his budget. So it's really unfortunate and has been causing a lot of concern among progressives and people who've supported President Obama for several campaigns.
Well, and ideas like a simple one, like raising the cap on wages subject to the Social Security tax, as you say, it polls well. Not only is it not in the president's budget, it's not in the media conversation either, and it makes it less possible for people to think of as a doable thing.
It really is unfortunate that the media isn't presenting the public with all of the options. Because, you know, as voters, as people who weigh in with their congresspeople, they really need to know the full range of options out there and who would be affected. So I'm really glad that shows like yours are there to help people understand that they're not being given all the options by the mainstream media.
We've been speaking with Nicole Wu, Director of Domestic Policy at the Center for Economic and Policy Research. You can find them on the web at CPER.net. Thank you very much for joining us today on Counterspin.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
The evidence that Dr. Kermit Gosnell ran an illegal abortion clinic under grisly conditions in Philadelphia seems to be strong. Gosnell is currently on trial for murder and other charges arising out of what is being called his House of Horrors abortion clinic. Gosnell's trial has received substantial media coverage following a conservative media campaign to draw attention to it. But it's still not enough for some who wish to equate the dubious Dr. Gosnell with legal and professional abortion providers. Our guest, Aaron Grant, works for an independent abortion provider in Philadelphia and writes for RH Reality Check, where she recently registered her own media criticism over coverage of the Dr. Gosnell story. Thanks for joining us on Counterspin, Aaron Grant.
Hey, thank you so much.
Well, in your piece for RH Reality Check, you argue that it's not so much the quantity of the coverage as the quality and the depth.
I feel as though there's a lot of information that's being shared. It's just what people are deciding to talk about and what people are deciding not to talk about. And when you work for an abortion provider, or when you are an abortion provider that has, as you said earlier, a professional standard of care, we actually work for our patients. And so we're not talking about the women who Gosnell was serving. We're not asking the deeper questions about why someone would go to a clinic that was not sanitary, or I have actually been there myself. There were cats inside of the facility. So who is his patient, and how does abortion care relate to having patients who are mostly women of color and underserved, underinsured, seeking those services in unsavory conditions because they needed abortion care? Obviously, the main factor is that he was willing to see women for very little money. He was running an operation that was able to provide services like sliding scale anesthesia, which doesn't exist, and he was in a neighborhood that was surrounded by reputable hospitals and other clinics, and he was really offering hundreds of dollars less than what even a small-scale abortion clinic would charge. So I really do think that when we talk about women who are without insurance or women who don't have access to financial means to be able to take care of unplanned or unwanted pregnancy, that we are talking about the women that normal licensed providers can turn away.
And you seem to suggest that in looking at substandard clinics like Dr. Gosnell's, we may be looking at the future in some places, some states, for instance, where there are passing even greater restrictions and there's harassment and political pressure. Tell me a little bit about that.
I do allude to it in the piece. As I said, Bubba Carpenter from Mississippi had stated that the abortion providers or the abortion community is saying that women are going to do it themselves. Well, I don't actually believe that that's something that we even have to say. I feel like Gosnell highlights and really shows that women will receive abortion care whether there's providers or not. So when we're talking about what happens in states like North Dakota when women aren't even able to get a medical abortion, or in Mississippi where there's only one clinic, North Dakota also has one clinic, but where there's places where there's not a lot of options, it's erroneous for us to think that abortion is not happening.
We're seeing a lot of coverage, and a lot of that coverage covers the grisly, the House of Horrors aspects of the story. Are we seeing reporters very often delve into the deeper aspects of the story where they look at the economic, the insurance issues, the access issues that drive women to substandard clinics like this?
No, we're not seeing the real debate about how race and how class is putting this particular clinic in a very special spot. The grand jury in 2011 said that they thought that the oversights were because of the women that were being served, that the women that were being served were women that were poor and women that were of color. And so we are seeing a lot about what happened at Gosnell's clinic. We're seeing a lot of, as you say, grisly details, but we're not hearing the other half of the story, which is right now Pennsylvania is taking a look at the Affordable Care Act, and it's almost definite that abortion will not be for purchase, which seems like that would be a story. We have a major national story happening with a doctor that was performing for over 40 years not providing services that are at a quality standard of care, and he is being given all of this attention, yet the real meat and potatoes, I think, of the story of women going to places because they are very cheap at the cost of themselves is not being addressed in our Senate. So to me, that would be the big story. There's this whole case going on. We have everybody from USA Today to the New York Times to the Atlantic in Philadelphia right now, but nobody has looked at what's about to go through in our Senate bills.
Well, there's certainly tons of different angles to cover there. There seems to be two pieces that need to be taken on here. You've just covered the part of the story, the sin of omission, if you will, that part of the story that's not being reported. But there's another problem with what is being reported, a sin of commission, if you will, about the Gosnell Clinic. For instance, on the April 12th O'Reilly Factor, Jeffrey McCall, a communications professor at DePauw University, equated Gosnell with all abortion providers when he told the O'Reilly Factor the Gosnell story, quote, does show a darker side of the whole abortion controversy. And you've got some grisly, inhumane details from this case that are coming out and confronting directly this notion of freedom of choice, close quote.
That's like equating Steve Martin in Little Shop of Horrors to a dentist. That's not what is happening for 99% of providers who include counseling and dignity in their abortion care. There's no way that you can make synonymous someone who does not have a license with someone who has a facility that runs with standards and protocols. That doesn't make any sense. This is not a real facility. It's an unsafe and unsanitary place of business. So I don't know where the soapbox of this is highlighting abortion care. He wasn't necessarily providing abortion care, but he was doing abortion, which is, you know, the termination of a pregnancy.
We've been speaking with Erin Grant, a Philadelphia abortion provider and contributor to RH Reality Check, where you can read her report on the Gosnell trial. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Erin Grant.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.